Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. Let me just start by saying, wow, we have an absolutely fabulous interview coming up with Sylvain Charlebois. He is the director of the Dalhousie Food Analytics Lab. This is our go-to experts when it comes to food prices. I'll be asking simple questions like, how much has food gone up over the last 4 years? But it's beyond that. What's the state of the environment right now? This is something none of us can avoid. I think you're going to be surprised at some of the taxation issues around food. No, there's a whole list. I can't do it justice right now other than to say, listen to Sylvain. I've also going to be talking with Mike Levy about productivity per capita. That's what this Bank of Canada rang the big alarm bell over. And I've got more information as to why. I've got Victor, I've got Ozzy. And by the way, the change in capital gains taxes, well, we're going to be talking a lot about that today, but specifically on real estate, Ozzy's got a nice group of questions that you should be asking your tax professional. All about that, but I think very pertinent, especially at this time. But first, a ton of reaction over the increase in the capital gains tax inclusion rate. Lots of back and forth, but the fundamental difference goes beyond the usual question of how much tax should the government take. You know, you've got some people like former NDP leader Thomas Mulcair believing that once the government takes over 50%, it's no longer taxation, it's confiscation. What should be obvious, but doesn't seem to be to politicians and some economists, is that millions of Canadians feel like they're taxed to death. Way beyond the income tax, and because you've got sales taxes and liquor taxes and gas taxes and carbon tax and excise tax and property tax. I think it's completely underappreciated by the feds and some economists, but that gets to the heart of the opposition to the carbon tax. People say, I've had enough. And I think that's some of the opposition to the increase in capital gains tax from people who it doesn't even impact. Now, obviously, there are others who think that's not the case and continue to suggest that the rich people don't pay their fair share. Although I got to tell you, I still want to run into somebody who understands what they already pay. I'll just give you a quick example. You know, it's the latest numbers from StatsCan. Top 1% of Canadians, income earners, well, that's 300,000. They start making 271,000 plus and over to be in that 1%. Well, they earn 10.4% of total income in Canada, but they pay well more than double of that in federal, provincial, and territorial income tax, 22.6%. By the way, the bottom 50% of income earners, that's 14.6 million taxpayers. They earn 41,000 and under. They earn about 19% of total income and pay 6.2% of total federal, provincial, and territorial taxes. So there, you can decide if someone's paying enough or not. But there are a lot of aspects that get well beyond that. And today I'm going to focus on one fundamental fact that's consistently being ignored. I thought it was summed up beautifully, by the way, by an Alberta doctor. His name is Dr. Doug Eielson. By the way, I heard after the fact he happens to be a former Liberal MP, and he writes this. I am a physician, and I'm married to a physician. We will never have to worry about paying off our mortgage, making car payments, or affording food. If the changes in capital gain means we pay more tax so that social programs are more economically viable, we're okay with that. I mean, seriously, I read that and go, are you kidding me? More economically viable because of tax increases. Boy, that's a confusion shared by many who simply don't understand that before money can be taxed and redistributed, it has to be earned. The best way to protect social programs is with a strong economy. And that's exactly why former Liberal Finance Minister Bill Morneau stated he rejected the idea of increasing capital gains taxes, calling it, in quotes, a negative to our long-term goal, which is productive growth and investment in the economy. That's a sentiment echoed by former Governor of the Bank of Canada and a Liberal Party stalwart, Mark Carney, who stated, in quotes, we must first acknowledge that we actually have less to spend because we've become less productive. And unless we turn that around, Canadian prosperity for all Canadians will be severely compromised. In other words, declining productivity per capita, along with declining investment per capita per worker, is a threat to our social programs, not low taxation. I'm going to talk more about that with Michael Levy in just a moment. But thinking that increasing taxes is the way to protect our social program while ignoring the importance of economic growth is so profoundly misguided, it's hard to know what to say. But maybe I'll try this. Check out the difference in government tax revenue in a recession versus periods of robust economic growth. Come on, Obviously, tax revenues are far higher when you get strong economic growth. I mean, it's incredible that people don't appreciate that straightforward fact. Now, I'm not going to go into it with so much detail, but there's one other aspect I want to remind you of. People who support higher taxes are actually saying that they think government is more efficient in spending, investing our money than the businesses and people who earned it. That's a proposition with absolutely no evidence. Well, the evidence of government mismanagement, incompetence, and ineptitude is reflected in every Auditor General's report and the Parliamentary Budget Office reports. And yet proponents of higher taxes are not bothered one bit by research or the multitude of examples of government mismanagement and waste. Instead, they're held hostage by an ideology of big government with an unblemished record of failure. Now, it's not surprising that those people who diminish the importance of economic growth and instead think that higher levels of taxation is the key to prosperity and protecting our social program, well, they don't care and they don't consider the impact of raising taxes on investment, like the capital gains increase. So not surprisingly, they ignore the unprecedented warning of an emergency by the Bank of Canada and a threat to our standard of living due to the decline in productivity and capital investment per capita. And by the way, please note the Bank of Canada wasn't warning that our taxes are too low. I got more on this coming up, as I say, with Mike Levy. So much more coming on this show. Got a great shocking stat. A quote of the week that finally explains how do governments come up with these wacky, incompetent ideas like you can increase the population, but you don't need a housing plan. That's an example. Well, we've got the reason why coming up on Money Talks. You know, it's interesting. There's all sorts of subjects that, you know, aren't that familiar to people. And one of them, when we talk about the economy, is the measure of productivity per capita. Investment per capita is a little easier because that's just simply how much investment we're putting in per worker. A big warning, by the way, is how we've been failing on that score and declining on that score. Bank of Canada came out with another warning. It was this week. But the productivity per capita is simply saying how much is the output per worker? So obviously, the more output, the more money's getting made, the stronger the economy, and people's wages are more secure, if not raising. I'm going to bring Mike Levy in that. Mike, I'm sort of nervous talking about something big time like productivity per capita, but come on, it's unprecedented for the Bank of Canada to come out and say, we're cracking the warning and the emergency bell. So yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that's back in the spotlight, and finally, when we start talking about things like that.
Well, Mike, what's also unprecedented, and this really gets to me, you never see or rarely see stories about the economy on the front page of a newspaper. It is international news. It's news what's going on in the country. There's some political, but you don't see economic. The Globe and Mail, their online edition on Wednesday, the three top stories on the front page. Canada's per capita GDP output dropped 7% below trend. Second one, Bank of Canada officials split on rate cut timing, but agree easing will be gradual. Third one, Mark Carney says federal budget not focused enough on growth. And of course, there is the federal budget was released, the new tax grab on capital gains. Income is making news every day. What I'm saying is economics, which you say is for grown-ups, you know what? I think Canadians are starting to grow up because that's the news that they're looking at, looking for, and that's what the newspaper is putting on the front page.
Yeah, it certainly got people's attention. I'll just get a little reminder coming up in a moment. I've got Sylvain Charlebois of the Dalhousie Agri-Food Analytics talking about the rise in food prices over the last 4 years, what's happening right now, and all the contributions that taxation make and other regulations, et cetera. But again, because it's hit home, people are getting, you know, you are noticing. And I guess the big thing I'd like people to make that connection to is when you have a falling GDP, that's the economy, growth per person, growth per capita, you're going to have a lower standard of living. And I would say that half of Canadians are already experiencing that. Our young people are already going to experience it because they are priced out of the housing market in major urban centers. That's a lower standard of living. But that's why economists focus on this, because of the direct relationship with the standard of living. And, you know, when you see these many quarters of decline, the stagnation over a number of years, that's what gets people's attention.
And Mike, that's why it's on the front page, because it's gotten people's attention. And this new budget, which was going to go after the wealthiest of Canadians, is impacting Canadians across the income board. And most of the talk now is about the stagnating real GDP growth per capita, which is now 7% below its long-term trend line, and begs the question, what makes an economy grow is a function of two important things, and they are absolutely labor, but capital. Capital is what makes it go. Investment of capital to open factories, to open offices, to create jobs, to make it easier for Canadians to make a living, and we are not attracting capital internally or from outside the country.
Yeah, as I said, the Bank of Canada literally just came out with something on that saying, oh my goodness, we've got, you know, they said, and these are their words. It says, when we compare when you compare Canada's recent productivity record with that of other countries, what really sticks out is how much we lag in investment in machinery, equipment, and importantly, intellectual property. Those are their words this week. And that's what they're talking about. How can we compete? And Mike, let me just digress for a second, say, where's the impact on people's investments? Well, on Money Talks at the World Outlook Conference for 4 years, we've had speakers recommend having a real chunk of your money in the U.S. Now, it's more nuanced than that, and I'm going to talk to Andrew Rulin about that coming up. But basically, because how can we compete if the U.S. is spending $28,000 per worker and Canada is spending $15,000 per worker? Over time, you can't compete with that. Hence, that's why their sectors are growing so much. And sorry, Mike, I'm going on, but quickly back to the capital gains. It is worrisome when you get the tech sector speaking out so boldly as they have about the impact on capital investment for the tech sector. So it all comes together here.
It does, Mike. And back to what you were saying about the Bank of Canada. The Bank of Canada never gets into a discussion on government policy, but Carolyn Rogers, the senior deputy governor of the bank, said the country is facing an emergency of weak productivity and tepid levels of business investment. That is a narrow pointing right at the federal government, both. And I know it wasn't meant to criticize politically, but what it is criticizing the government itself.
But it's economic policy. I mean, you can't rhetoric your way out of some of the distractions or the, you know, things like, well, what is your productivity? What are you spending per worker? What are the outcomes of that? It doesn't matter who's in power. You know, you need productivity growth. Doesn't matter who's in power. You need capital investment to be attracted to this country. That's the only solution here. There's no solution and no raising of our standard of living, and especially the more vulnerable in society, which, you know, is a huge percentage now, without capital investment, without economic growth. So yeah, it's a key subject. And I, as you said, and I'm glad to see it on the front page of the online version of the Globe and Mail, because it impacts all of us.
Mike, you know, and it does impact all of us. And maybe if we're going to leave it with a thought, it's not the wealthy, like the prime minister and finance minister said. It's the mom and pops. It's the you and me. It's somebody who bought a small piece of property and worked to pay it off so they would have that as part of their nest egg when they retire. And the government has gone after them as being wealthy, and we are going to raise the capital gains inclusion, and we're going to take their retirement, part of their retirement, away from them. It just doesn't wash.
Yeah, I thought it was a mistake to say it only applied to so few people, and then people come out of the woodwork. Like, I've had a cabin for 40 years. I invested in a rental property 28 years ago. You know, all of them are being impacted. And I said, you know, the doctors, the architects, the engineers who've set up corporations for their business. Yeah, I think it was a mistake to say it was such a small portion when clearly it's much greater than that. And of course, it's going to engender much more discussion. In the meantime, Mike, thanks for taking time to join our.
Thanks, Mike. Talk to you next week.
I call them the big three when it comes to our cost of living. What are gasoline prices doing? By the way, popping up on the West Coast, I saw this weekend. We've also got, of course, what the housing crisis across this country, rents, et cetera, and food prices. Well, we've been very fortunate on Money Talks to be able to call on Dr. Sylvain Charlebois. He's the Senior Director, Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. That's the go-to place when you want to find out what's going on in the food market. They call him the Food Professor, by the way, where you can find him on Twitter and also his own podcast. There's a lot of ways. I'll get into that later. First of all, Dr. Charlebois, we appreciate you finding time for us because this topic just keeps on giving.
Oh, absolutely. Every day there's something going on. And yeah, I'm happy to be involved with the with our collective discussion about the future of food. It's been pretty intensive the last 4 years for sure.
Yeah. Let me just, speaking of the last 4 years, we get our inflation numbers. Of course, they may be measured annually, might be measured month to month. But so we got food at about 1.9%, I think, which was predicted, by the way, by the Agri-Food Analytics Lab in their annual report that we'd get that decline. But a lot of people don't feel much better about it. And that's because they're worried more what the ultimate cost was, not the rise in cost over a particularly small period of time. So just basically, what are we talking about? If I look back 4 years, how much are, you know, and again, it depends on what food category, but how much are food prices up generally?
Yeah. So if you look at all food categories combined, the increase is about 24% since the start of COVID back in March of 2020. But that's not how people feel. In fact, about a month ago, we actually asked 9,000 Canadians. We asked them, how much do you think prices have actually gone up in the last 4 years? And the average answer we got was 78%.
Okay? Wow.
78%. Yeah. So that's a gap of 55% between fiction and reality. But that fiction, that perception is really important for the food industry because you're basically dealing with a disgruntled consumer, a consumer that is absolutely worried sick about his or her finances. And it's not just about food prices. It's the cost of living, real estate, yeah, mortgages, debt, everything happening at once. And that's why when people actually show up at the grocery store, they're absolutely trading down because it's a easy place to trade down. It's an easy place to save money.
Yeah, we've certainly seen surveys saying, yeah, I don't buy the same. I mean, I and my own family, we don't buy the same expensive cut of meat, for example, you know, still passing out when we see some of those prices because I've considered shopping with my bank manager for a loan instantly if I actually want to have a high grade piece of meat, which is just a thing in the past, by the way.
I know.
But,
yeah,
but there's other things that I think there's misconceptions, and I think they're fueled by politicians trying to hop on a hobby horse. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I know that, you know, I read the Conference Board of Canada's report on groceries. I read the Bank of Canada's. Both of them said, hey, we need more competition in this market. Bottom line, we need, and, you know, that, of course, competition gives me as a consumer more choice. But then I turn around, and it feels like almost on a daily basis, we've got the partner in government, the NDP, their leader, Jagmeet Singh, bad mouthing, you know, CEOs, like, you know, outing them, saying they're at fault, the greedy companies are at fault. And yet that overlooks so many other price pressures within this category. But first of all, let me just ask you, I mean, we are not having any success attracting, you know, major U.S. retailers, grocery retailers into our country. I can hardly think that that helps when they're bad-mouthed, you know, from the get-go, plus other obstacles.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, political optics aren't necessarily good for anybody looking at Canada, of course. Why would you want to conduct business in Canada only to be summoned in Ottawa every 3 months and be accused of profiteering? I mean, that's certainly not something that is helping. But what is certainly not helping at all is the state of our economy. I mean, if you actually look at the amount of money people are spending at the grocery store, in 2018, the average Canadian was actually spending $304, constant dollars, at the grocery store per month. We're down to 243. So people are retreating. People are spending less. They're trading down, buying cheaper food. They're going to the dollar store. I mean, it's really bad, Mike. So bad. GDP per capita is down also. There's less wealth. Incomes are stagnant. Why would you come to Canada when you look at some of that macroeconomic data discouraging anybody to invest in Canada? So we have Ottawa right now and Mr. Champagne dialing for grocers. There's a list of 12 grocers now that he has. If he calls one of the grocers on that list, my guess is that he's going to get an earful.
And that's an example, as I say, it's other things in terms of lack of competition. The taxation of groceries adds to the cost too. And you did you and your group did a great video on this. On, we've been moaning about shrinkflation, and I doubt there's a Canadian who hasn't noticed it. Like, how small is that bottle, or how small is that package?
Yeah.
Excuse me, fewer things. What I'll tell you, I didn't appreciate is you can get moved to a different tax category. You know, if we drop down, and I'll let you explain it better than I will, but you drop down and all of a sudden you're not a grocery, you're a snack food. Maybe elaborate a little bit on that, because that's part of the component prices of what I pay at the store.
Oh, absolutely. And this is what's mind-boggling about what's going on in Canada, Mike. You have a budget, a federal budget, spending our next generation's money, really, a lot of money. And you can think of a few things that wouldn't cost much that could actually make a huge difference in people's lives, like the snack tax. And what is the snack tax? It's pretty simple. When you go to the grocery store, there are 4,600 products that are taxable because, according to the CRA, they're considered as snacks, not food. Food is not taxable. Snacks are. But here's the thing about shrinkflation. If a product gets shrunk too much, it becomes a snack. For example, if you have a jug of ice cream of over 500 mil, you're fine. That's food. Below 500 mil, that's taxable. Okay. And a lot of companies have actually gone down to with jugs that are under 500 mil. Granola bar boxes, 6, not taxable. 5, taxable. So with the budget, Mr. Trudeau could have just easily said, you know what, we're going to be exempting any products that have been shrinkflated that are now taxable. And that would have saved people a lot of money. And guess what? People would have appreciated that measure because it's real and affects everyone every single day. So that sometimes I do wonder why. I mean, it's a low-hanging fruit for the government, for any government to do.
You know, it's interesting. Of course, anybody who's packed a lunch for an elementary school child or a, you know, high school child is certainly including those kinds of snacks usually.
Yeah.
And, you know, so feel it immediately. My theory on why they don't is because they don't know anybody. That's what I think across, you know, that I've been on and on about the fact that we haven't appreciated, you know, starting with COVID, where we said we're all in this together. And I said, no, we're not. You know, my personal circumstances are nowhere near sort of a single parent in a put in a lockdown situation in a one bedroom apartment, and the playgrounds are all roped off, you know, whatever it is. I said, I am not dealing with that. I am not sitting there worried if my paycheck is going to come in or I can't afford food. And my estimation looking at polls is we're at about 55% of Canadians are in that. So why didn't they address it? I said, because they don't know anybody. They literally
probably
don't know people at the
You're
low
probably right, Mike,
level.
But I'll be honest with you. I mean, taxing anything, we're taxing everything now. And taxing food is immoral. I'm sorry, but it's immoral. I think there are ways to make the grocery store a little friendlier for those who are really operating with a tight budget. And right now, I mean, we're quick at pointing fingers at companies who are gouging and profiteering, but we're not quick at looking at policy making food more expensive, including the zero base policy at CRA. And by the way, the CRA, I know it's going to hurt, Mike, but the CRA in the last 12 months has hired 5,000 more people. 5,000. Oh, yeah.
And by the way, I don't want to get too off topic. I've seen what they're doing, and I'm being serious. I've seen some horrendous cases of we're going to audit you from something well before I thought the audit could take place, you know, 6 or 7 years. No, they went back further for a business. And I'm going, what else are they going to be doing? They're going to be looking at the past to see if there's any money there. And of course, looking at the future. But yes, that's it's a direction that the government's choosing to go.
And you could argue that, well, Revenue Canada is revenue for the government, but when you look at the correlation between the number of employees added to the CRA payroll versus government revenues, there's just no connection at all. So you do wonder what's going on. And of course, it's been outed that the carbon tax is also contributing to the number, to the greater number of people working at the CRA. So there's lots of policies. We're nationalizing everything. Okay. We're nationalizing the school food program. We're nationalizing the daycare program. It's great. If that's what Canadians want, that's great. But at the same time, you have to accept the fact that you're going to see a much larger bureaucracy in Ottawa.
Yeah, and I got a feeling people be listening to this and tearing their hair out, saying they are not on the side where they want to see more government intervention. And that's a political choice that we're going to be making and we'll be debating during the upcoming election. One side. I've never seen bigger distinctions, by the way, Sylvain, between the parties' approaches. And yep. One is because the federal government, and many support that, they want to see more and more government intervention. What were used to be private sector is not any longer. Dental care, pharma care, food. There's legitimate questions about the government's ability to pull that off, given some of the other track record. But there's those who don't. They don't want the government continually more involved, a bigger bureaucracy, which is, what is it, up 68%? I've had a chance to talk to the parliamentary budget officer, and he says the key question is Canadians have to ask, what did you get for it?
Exactly. No, I think your observation is bang on, Mike. Typically during an election in Canada, it's always about the fight of the center. Who's going to be defining the center in Canada, okay? Whether it's the Liberals, Conservatives, whoever. This time around, it's going to be about ideology and vision, absolutely. And I think the legacy of the Trudeau government is to be incredibly divisive. And this is what we're seeing in the United States as well. So people can say, well, divisiveness actually brings people to talk about policy, meaningful policy, but divisiveness can also actually bring anger, hostility, and violence as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And another time I'll go into that with you, what our modeling shows, because it's been absolutely adequate or accurate, pardon me. It's been accurate all the way along about those kind of social trends. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone else whose model called Trump victory in 2016, Brexit would go through. We did all of that, put it on the air. That trend is well entrenched at this point and leads to very big changes.
And that divisiveness has affected food policy in our country, really. You're seeing it with Environment Climate Change Canada, looking at farmers, looking at the agri-food sector overall. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of tension that's actually generated by good politics but bad policy. Yeah.
And so many different areas we could allude to on that. Let me come back to this, though, because, again, the work that you people do at the Agri-Food Analytics Lab, you were one of the big proponents. I'd call you the lead person on this, saying, you wanted to see bigger discounts when food got toward their expiry date, and you were holding some accountable for that, and I think successfully accountable. That begged a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah.
For some people. One is it safe? Are Canadians in general more inclined to eat food because of the discount, when they get toward that best till date? What did you guys find out about that? Because you did extensive research on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We were glad to get some attention about this study because we want to inform the public about what best before dates are all about. And best before dates, or best before, doesn't mean bad after. And a lot of people don't know that. They think it's actually a really strict rule. Bad after that date, you got to throw away. It's really up to the consumer to decide. The consumer, to me, is the most important risk manager in the entire food supply chain. And we should remind ourselves of that all the time. Expiry dates, that's different. Expiry dates will apply to maybe 1.5% of all foods we buy. And you shouldn't eat or consume a product past an expiry date. But for best before dates, people should use judgment. But here's the thing, Mike, because of higher food prices, people are actually pushing the envelope a little bit further. They are actually 58% of Canadians are now eating food past their best before dates, more so than than 12 months ago. And of course, they're also looking at issues in relation to packaging. They're also looking at issues related to conserving food at home as much as possible, using freezers and things like that. So people are perhaps even wasting less food, but they're probably risking more as well.
That's a distinction I hear very few people understand. The difference between an expiry date and a best before date, I think they get confused all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's why it's important to come out with these studies so you can have an opportunity to explain to the public what the differences are. Because if you go on the CFIA website, which is atrocious, let's be honest, it's not friendly. It's not friendly for anyone to understand. It's important to remind people of those distinctions.
You know, I'm going to come back to again what a more profound or longer term solution is. We did talk about, but I want to get one more quick comment from you on the carbon tax and the impact on food prices, because of course the carbon tax is applied all along the chain, you know, whether it's a manufacturing facility, whether it's the transportation, et cetera, right into the shelves. So a quick comment on the impact of the carbon tax on food prices.
So we don't know for sure what the impact is, to be honest, but as we progress towards a carbon tax of $170 a metric ton by 2030, we're going to be probably seeing a measurable impact over time. The real impact that can be measured now is within the supply chain. You can see that wholesale prices are going up much faster than the U.S. Industrial prices are going up much faster than the U.S. So that gap is really just making our food sector less competitive. And guess what could happen, Mike? I mean, right now you could see probably some companies leave Canada to go somewhere else like the United States just because the Canadian regime or the market in Canada is impossible to make any companies actually become competitive. And in BC in particular, I mean, if there is one place where manufacturing is hurting, is certainly in BC. It's very hard because of the fact that you have little access to industrial land in BC. Building a food manufacturing facility is very difficult. So add the carbon tax to that argument. No company will ever even think about building anything in the province or elsewhere in Canada. So there's a lot going on that nobody really seemed to measure. So we have Ottawa not even measuring the impact of the carbon tax on the environment. And now they're basically refunding everyone, companies, people. So you do wonder, Mike, so what are we doing now? Like, what's the purpose of this particular policy? And frankly, when you talk to farmers, food manufacturers, retailers, they have no clue where Ottawa is going with this.
And it's a reminder how broad this food chain is. We look at the end product and, you know, when we go to a grocery store, but there's so many components. And now, for example, I'm worried about the upward pressure on energy costs, you know, and we've seen that. And again, you mentioned going out in BC, you should see the price of gasoline, the highest in North America, a big 6 cent jump on Friday. That it took 6 cents per liter jump, you know, well, that's going to get reflected because of transportation costs and other, I mean, the power for manufacturing, the list goes on. Yeah. And I just think Canadians, will finish with this, the Canadians are not well aware of all of the price components that go in to the ultimate price I pay on the shelf. You know, certainly not just grocery stores.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so that compounding effect needs to be better appreciated. And frankly, when you go back many years ago, no one in Ottawa has actually ever looked at how the policy could impact food affordability in Canada. And that's really, that's reckless. It's really simply reckless, because when you're actually compromising a nation's food security by way of implementing bad policy, that's just bad government. And so you got to be really extremely careful with how you handle things. And to me, the Trudeau government's policy around carbon pricing is the most important one. If it is the most important one, you got to measure its performance, and nothing is being done right now. I think every Canadian wants to become better environmental stewards, and even pay taxes if that's what we need to do. But at the end of the day, you need to build an argument to the Canadian public on what is being accomplished here, and nothing has been clear for Canadians.
Well, as you said, and we had the parliamentary budget officer, Yves Giraud, tell us that there's been no cost-benefit analysis on any of the green policies. You know, and
yeah.
So what are we getting in return? How do we know which is most effective?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, another subject, yeah. Of course. Look, I know you're on a tight timeline today, but I got to tell you, we so much appreciate your work, and I want to invite people to go to The Food Professor on Twitter. Always a good summary of the stuff they're working on at the Dalhousie Food Agri-Food Analytics Lab there, new studies that come out. That's how I keep abreast of it, and I invite you to do the same. Sylvain Charlebois, thanks so much. You know we appreciate your time and your expertise.
My pleasure, Mike.
Time now for the quote of the week. Now, this is a serious question. It's one I've been asking certainly over the last few years, and it doesn't have anything to do with ideological differences, but rather the lack of common sense. Come on, things like the failure to plan for backup power for wind and solar, you know, as if the sun shines all day and the wind blows, or, you know, in Germany, they got rid of the nuclear plants without any power replacement ready to go. I mean, it's inexplicably stupid. It's the same way, though, of course, we've been watching this massive increase in population, but we had no housing plan to deal with it. As I say, that's not ideological, that's just stupid. So how does it happen, though? Well, that brings me to the quote of the week. Jerry Uscim offers an answer. He wrote an article in The Atlantic entitled, "Power Causes Brain Damage." It's written in 2017. In quotes, "Subjects under the influence of power," he found in studies spanning two decades, acted as if they had suffered a traumatic brain injury, becoming more impulsive, less risk-aware, and crucially, less adept at seeing things from other people's point of view. Well, I read that and I went, right on. You know, we've been talking about, as you just heard with Rob Levy, certainly me off the top, and it's the biggest topic of conversation, is the rise in the capital gains taxes, but also, and the impact on our productivity, on what our economy is really like as GDP per capita, investment per capita is the underlying variable there. I want to talk about, though, the impact on our investments specifically with that. I'm going to bring in Andrew Ruland, Integrated Wealth Management in Calgary, and I'll just say up front, Andrew's got a webinar coming up on that very subject, or broader than that, but digging down into these kind of things that are happening. I mean, my gosh, we're swimming in geopolitical events and changes every day, as an example, this kind of a tax change. Andrew, first of all, appreciate you taking time, and I bet you've got more than one or two questions when this capital gains gain increase kind of hit the fan. I certainly did.
Yeah, hitting the fan, I think, is probably the right expression. The immediate response I had was, this is kind of like another straw on the camel's back, and are we breaking the Canadian, you know, economy camelback, you know, to take that to an absurd level? But the fact is it's about all the things that have come before, in terms of labor costs, in terms of payroll taxes, in terms of other regulatory things, which just makes Canada a less and less competitive environment for most businesses.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. I'm really glad you're saying it's not the whole deal. It's just one more piece of straw on the camel's back. And I mean, that's what people have to appreciate, that Canada had a reputation of not being particularly competitive, especially versus the United States, and every stat would support that. You know, we talked all day in the show so far about productivity per capita. You know, well, that's a key measure, investment per worker per capita. I mean, output is obviously key to investment. And it was sort of, I mean, that was already out there. So this hardly helps the perception. And as you have to deal with that, I mean, as the famed Jim Dine said, it's all about our perceptions, you know. You know, wrote a big book on that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's part of that environment that now you have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing is that, like, from a broad perspective, of course, Canada has been lagging behind in productivity growth. In fact, last year we had we went backwards by 2% in productivity. And in the U.S., they went ahead by 5%. So that's just a 7% gap just on that 1 year in 2023. Mm-hmm. And so that has a big impact on where capital wants to go, especially when it comes to innovation. But that's where this whole idea of should I invest in Canada or should I invest in the U.S. or should I shift completely out of Canada? And I think that's kind of a false binary choice. I think it's more about the sectors, because as you've mentioned many times on the show and is obvious to money managers, Canada doesn't really have a tech sector other than, say, Shopify, right? So if you want exposure to tech and AI and things like that, of course, the U.S. is the place to go. But here in Canada, we have some differences that are often weaknesses compared to the U.S., but we also have some significant strengths. We are hewers of wood and drawers of water and drillers of hydrocarbons. And so that's our strength. And I think that we need to play to that. And I'd say the good news about what the Trudeau Singh inspired budget is that it's not going to affect global demand for commodities, which we are rich in. It's terrible for banking. It's terrible for venture capital. It's terrible for telecom. It's terrible for a lot of different things, but at least it's not going to hurt the commodity sector too much.
Yeah. But that's a very important point to make, that it's sectoral doesn't mean, you know, I guess the broader point you were making up front is you want exposure to the U.S. Mm-hmm. in those areas that have strength. Technology is one. And, you know, I mean, I like to say we've got a burgeoning technology sector, but it's not the size of, you know, the so-called Magnificent Seven. You know, Canada isn't going to be a leader in AI. We'll have participants. We're not going to be a leader in AI. Mm-hmm. And that has to be a question of how much that's been evaluated into the stocks already. You know, where do we go from here? Are you short term, long term? All the things I know you're asking your clients, you know, nonstop. But it is that environment. And what I liked isn't the right word, but I thought a benefit of that capital gains increase is it brought the conversation forward. My guess is we've talked more about productivity in the last couple of weeks than we had even this. Despite the fact, like Bank of Canada warnings and other warnings, and any major economist has been worried about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's our standard of living that we're talking about. So I like that we're talking about it then, but as you say, take a little bit more nuanced approach, remove the politics and just look, where are my damn opportunities here? And your point about commodities well taken and about oil is well taken. I mean, we've never had a drawdown in oil demand, never. Mm-hmm. You know, so where are we going to play in that? What, you know, if you like that sector, how are you going to do it long term, you know, sort of thing? So I think those are all the, I mean, you're doing a webinar on it, I know, but those are all the great questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, again, when I think about what Canada's strengths are, and here in Calgary, obviously, we're immersed in the oil and gas story. But global demand it's waxed and waned in terms of its growth. But it's never really declined significantly, yeah. Other than during kind of the false closure around 4 years ago, right? With the COVID crash, and that's just because the world shut down temporarily. But the fact is that even if we don't have great building demand from China, we still have 2 or 3 billion people around the world, maybe 4 billion people around the world, who would like to cook with gas or electricity produced by gas instead of burning dung, and, you know, getting all of the negative health effects from that. So that is, you know, as those parts of the third world want to come into the second world, that is a tailwind or, you know, a push from below in terms of demand.
Yeah, we're seeing a huge push in coal, mm-hmm. too. You know, as you mentioned, natural gas. We'd like to see natural gas being used. I mean, that should satisfy at least some people worried about climate change with the lower emissions versus coal. But man, I'm looking at that coal mm-hmm. increase. You know, everywhere I look, it seems like a big bump. Because, I mean, the bottom line is your standard of living is directly linked to your energy consumption. And as you say, you know, people want a better yes. life. You know, hundreds of millions of billions of people want a better life. So that will mean more energy demand. And I just think, as you say, there's opportunities within that. And I guess that's what your stock selection is all about, you know, portfolio mm-hmm. selection. But, and as I say, you're going to do a webinar, you're going to get more into that. But I also don't want to leave out the interest rate uncertainty we're dealing with now. And again, how people can, I as an investor, just find it a lot easier when I think I'm going to park my money at 5% than going back a few years. And I don't want to park my money at 0.5%, which we were all experiencing. So at least it's a more positive discussion, but you must have, you know, lots of people looking for that with this uncertainty, geopolitically, interest rate, U.S. election coming up, all of that stuff.
We certainly did. And going back a year, we certainly had some folks who were asking more about that. And, you know, we did make some shifts from equities a little bit into some additional kind of short-term stuff. But that was really for folks who were quite skittish.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing for a portfolio manager right now, so I'll drill down kind of into the equity component. Our portfolio managers are not always fully invested. And it used to be that you would really be punished for taking money off the table and holding cash, other than if the you know, the equity markets were really cratering. But now it's like, okay, well, you know, I've got a good gain implicit in stock XYZ, and so I'm going to maybe trim my exposure to 2/3 or half, or get completely out of it. And I'm going to ring the cash register. You never go broke taking a profit. And we're at least going to get some yield in T-bills while we're waiting for the next opportunity. So it's opened up that we can get paid a little more to wait in cash, both at the individual investor level, but also at the equity manager level.
Yeah, I'm just smiling thinking of, you know, there's no shortage of things for you to talk about in your webinar, which is, I'll let people know, we'll put it up on our sites and social media, et cetera, but it's, and there's, the thing is, there's always limited opportunity through the technology, but on Tuesday, it's 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific, and you can do the math, you could actually go to 9 p.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. See how quick I am with that stuff, Andrew. Well,
and what,
that plus three was right there.
And what time in Maui?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I know that. 5 p.m. in the afternoon on Tuesday. Oh, I'm doing well. But you know, there is no shortage of things. So you're going to hit on all these topics. But another one I'm just throwing out at you. I bet you got to talk about gold. I bet you've been talking about gold because I know your people had a position in it.
Yes, we have for off and on for quite some time. And, you know, of course, we had a very solid run from 22 to 23. And then we bought again in August of 23 and almost got stopped out a few times, including almost getting stopped out three times in early March. And we were watching the price action. And obviously, we've had a good run, particularly in the gold stocks. They're looking a little bit tired right now, and a little bit of backing and filling would probably be helpful. But we have a lot of people saying, well, is this the time to cash in, you know, our gold holdings? And our general theme is, you know, with declining confidence in government, why would we want to necessarily take everything off the table unless we, you know, make some incredible technical turns or something? And I mean, the geopolitics and the macroeconomic effects, or the setup with all of the different catalysts and powder kegs that are out there, that's what has a lot of people really on edge. And honestly, that's typically when gold continues to shine.
Well, as I say, you're not going to have shortage of things to talk about, but I want to tell people it's April 30th is Tuesday, April 30th. And you're doing it at 5 p.m. Maui time. No, but 6 p.m. No, that's 4 p.m. Maui time. 4 p.m. Sorry, I got that wrong. I said I didn't. No, it's 2 hours, 3 hours behind Alberta, 2 hours behind BC. So it's 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. It's a 60-minute webinar. Take advantage of it. It's at the best price. It's absolutely free, but you have to go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and sign up for it. mikesmoneytalks.ca. We'll put it up there. Sign up. Don't wait for it. Sign up soon. It'll be happening on Tuesday evening. Andrew, thanks for finding time. That's going to be an interesting session.
It is. And thank you, Mike. Have a good weekend.
Time now for the shocking stat of the week. Well, through our tax dollars, you have to know that we're investing tens of billions of dollars for EV-related battery plants. And of course, taxpayers didn't have a choice. I mean, the decisions are made by politicians. You know, Prime Minister Trudeau, Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne, and of course, Ontario Premier Doug Ford. By the way, none of which are investment professionals or analysts. But well documented by Premier Ford's response, or illustrated, I should have said, by Premier Ford's response when asked how many jobs this week's $5 billion subsidy for Honda is going to produce. Well, the immediate answer from the Prime Minister was 1,000 jobs. Heck, that's $5 million per job, though. But I love Premier Ford, who said that you couldn't put a price on it. I think it's safe to say that when we're talking about investments and tax dollars, we are putting a price on it. But not talking about it, I think, is a bit of a warning sign. But no matter what the results, as famed economist Thomas Sowell says, they don't have to worry about it. As he says, it's hard to imagine a more stupid and more dangerous way of making decisions than by putting those decisions in the hands of people who pay no price for being wrong. So at a time when polls show declining consumer interest in electric vehicles in Canada, along with fierce competition from China for competition to Western manufacturers, we as taxpayers are committing billions in EV purchase subsidies for the well-to-do, by the way, and tens of billions in tax dollars to electric battery manufacturing. And, well, we actually don't know how much exactly. But as BlackRock says, over $52 billion is on the industry electric vehicles as a whole, which is shocking because that's three times the size of the Canadian auto industry. But here's the manufacturing sector I'm trying to add up here. Shocking stats. $16.3 billion to Volkswagen, $15 billion to Stellantis, $4.24 billion to Northvolt, $1.288 billion to Ford, and this week's announcement, $5 billion to Honda. That's just about $42 billion for EV battery manufacturing. But don't worry, I think most of us are going to be long gone before we see the results. Other than, well, so far Ford has postponed its plant for 2 years. Why? Because you got slowing consumer demand, and as I said, you got the competition from China. But in reply to this week's announcement of the $5 billion for Honda, here's what University of Toronto economist Professor Rob Gillenzo stated. This is such a horrendous use of public funds from two governments that seem more interested in fancy ribbon cutting than economic growth, core public services, or the responsible use of government resources. End of quote. But you can decide for yourself. Of course, we've been talking a lot about the capital gains and the impact on individuals. I mean, as I said just a few moments ago, it's absurd to think it was only something like 40,000 people when the budget itself says it hits 307,000 corporations, more people coming out of the woodwork. But one area, of course, is real estate. And that's why I've got to bring Ozzy Jurek in here. And Ozzy, there's a lot to this, but I want to get down. I bet you got a lot of calls on this, you know, first of all, because somebody has had a summer cabin for 25 years, you know, and may be caught within this, you know, a lake property, cottage owner. And there's other things too. So let's start with, I'm relying on you to give me some questions that I can ask my accountant, my tax professional. We're not giving advice here tax-wise, but we are trying to give you some questions you might want to check out if you found yourself caught in this category. So, you know, if your gain is above $250,000, which real estate is probably the number one asset where people experience that because it's leveraged, they have much more, et cetera, and you get above that, well, I mean, if you're below that, it's not impacting you, but above it, there's things to do. So I'm sure with your real estate action group, you've been talking about this. So give me an example of a question regarding a strategy that I might want to take to my tax professional.
Well, first of all, Mike, as you point out, I'm not an accountant. I'm not a tax advisor. I have great respect for both of those professions because it's getting more and more difficult. But first of all, there is a date of June 25th. Whatever you want to do to avoid taxes, not evade, but avoid taxes, you have to do by June 25th. And as you point out, in Ontario, cottage owners en masse are trying to sell, lake property owners. If you had a property for 10 years, it's got tripled in value. So the $250,000, if you own something that you expect to be the cap gain less than $250,000, don't worry about it. It still stays the same, unless you're a corporation, because they're not qualified to get that $250,000 exemption. So then there's some question, well, what can I do? Well, first of all, you can sell. And you sell the property, but you have to close before June 25th. But then you trigger all of the taxes. Let's say if you had $1 million in taxes accumulated, now you have to pay the taxes on that, even though it's the older rate. That may not have been your idea. So that's a bad thing. But there are others that you could do.
Yeah, I just to remind people that if they did, and I had those same calls. I had those calls, Ozzy, within 2 hours of the budget. I got some emails, you know, I mean, this was on people's mind, because this is the one area I would say, there's also, of course, the doctors are very concerned, and engineers, architects who formed a corporation of how they do business, dentists, the list is a long one there, and they're obviously concerned. But, and the Ontario Medical Association has made it clear, they think this will make us less attractive for doctors and have some people going out of the country, et cetera. But real estate would be number one other than that or with that. And so, you know, you can sell your real estate, but your point, I don't want to gloss over this. So if I had a $500,000 gain in my real estate, I pay under, and it settles before June 25th, I pay under the old rate. But the key word is I pay. Do right. I have that cash sitting around? Because it's going to increase my tax bill that I wasn't probably preparing for. So,
it's really jumped a spring this on you with 6 weeks to go. But there are things that you can ask your accountant. There is a rule, it's called the reserve, which is a deferral of capital gains. So what would happen is if you sell it before June 25th, but in the documents you say, I'm going to carry a mortgage for 4 years. Then with the first year being now and the other 4 years, you can get the capital gains spread over 5 years. What does it do? Well, it helps you, depending on what your income level is during those 5 years, you don't have to come up with all of the taxes that before June 25th, as to point out, which is otherwise necessary. The other thing is you can have sort of private off-market arrangement within your family. You could, for instance, gift a capital asset to your adult children, if you get along with them, that is, right? But think about it. You do eliminate the asset from the deemed disposition at death. It gets the gain at a lower rate, but there's a slew of other issues with that move. You know, apart, certainly if family gets along and so on, but it's not easy, but it's something to explore.
Well, again, and it shows that how pervasive this is, that you've got to do estate planning. This may be a good excuse to look at your estate, look at your will, you know, and then, of course, as you say, because if I gift, you're allowed to gift to your children who are above the age of 19, I think, Ozzy. I can't give to children. I can give to adult children, as you said.
Yes.
And again, check with your accountant, but I'm allowed to gift anything to them, including money, but in this case, it's going to be an asset. So it's deemed to be sold the day I do that. So if I do it June 20th, it's on the 20th. I do it June 3rd, it's on the 3rd, but it's deemed to be sold. I have to capture that into my income tax. And now it's an asset that belongs to my children. But as I say, it has maybe some benefits talking about estate, so you again talk to a professional. This is, as you can imagine, every tax change like this is an absolute boom to tax professionals, estate planners, you know, financial advisors. You know, it's like an annuity for them. But your point's well taken. That's another one to consider. Now, I want to go back to the person who sells before June 25th, completed the sale. And then there's this idea of taking back a reserve. So that's a question to ask. What about the reserve available for deferral of capital gain on my disposed of house in this case or other assets? So you can sort of mellow it out over the year. Does that mean that every year we qualify, or I guess all of that gain cumulatively qualifies for that, what is it, 1,250,000 capital gains? Lifetime exemption. So,
well, there's two different things, Mike.
Okay, good. That's what I'm asking. Yeah.
The lifetime exemption is going to be increased to $1.2 million. That has nothing to do with the capital gains tax per se that's bringing in on June 25th.
Great.
If that's what you want to do, if that's all you have, then you can wait till afterwards. You know, because if you have a lifetime exemption, again, talk to your accountant, but it's an exemption of that amount. But if you have already a lot of small companies have used up the 500,000 or 700,000 or whatever it was over their time, that's why it's important to talk to an accountant. But the other thing is, if you do sell it by June 25th, even if you create just the reserve the way you have agreed with the buyer, you get the money over 5 years, you still have to transfer title, right? You have costs with that. At the moment, whatever you sell before June 25th, there'll be costs attached. You have to pay the tax. You have to transfer it and so on. So it's a boondoggle.
But our point here is to talk to a professional. There are many things, avenues to go, as Ozzy's just elaborated for us. There's avenues to explore. Talk to a tax professional about it. And as I say, we can add in an estate professional too in this. And yeah, I remember the good old days, by the way, Ozzy, when we used to grandfather changes. Like people make investments based on the existing rules. Government says, these are your rules, you know, regulations, et cetera. You follow them. Then they change the rules of the game. In the old days, they used to grandfather that, saying if you're already in, you're under the old rules. If it's a new one, you're under these rules, which, you know, they like to throw around the word fair a lot. They love that word fair as if they're the arbiter of what's fair in the world. Well, that wouldn't be a bad place to start. We told you these were the rules. We're changing them. You're still protected. But, of course, I'm living in dreamland with that.
Well, the other thing to remember, though, pick your accountant also wisely. You want a real estate-oriented accountant. I use a guy by the name of Lucky Tour, T-O-O-R, in Maple Ridge, if you're in it. But you have all over the country, you have people that specialize because you need a specialist to help you with this.
Well, and you can also go to ozbuzz.ca. You've been talking about these issues, warning people about these issues. So that's ozbuzz.ca. Just tell Ozzy where to send it. You fill in. It's absolutely free. You get it on a weekly basis. So in the meantime, I'm not sure if I can say have a good week. I hope you do. I hope everyone personally does.
Well, thank you, Mike. And do remember something about accountants. Accountants know 100 ways to seduce a woman, but they don't know any women.
I borrow that for politicians, I say. Politicians have 100 opportunities to know, in quotes, the common man, the average person. They just don't bother to. Ozzy, have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.
I'm going to go live to the trading desk now and bring in Victor Adair, victoradair.ca. Vic, forgive me, I'm going to Barbara Walters pepper you with so many headlines. And we've been talking about this over the last while. There's just seems like so many events happening and, you know, major moves in markets, both up and down. Also, I think a reminder of how many international events impact something we may be looking at domestically. I'll give you a quick example, gold prices. You've been saying for several weeks now that you thought it was Chinese consumer buying, for example. Well, it still impacts our minds and our investors here. And if I go to the Canadian Mint to buy a maple leaf, it impacts me. So quick word on gold.
Well, the gold price ran up about $250 from middle of, what was that? I'm getting mixed up. From the middle of March to our highs here in April. And it's back off about $100 from there. The run to the roses, the highs that we made here about 2 weeks ago, I really think was goosed, like at the end in particular, by very aggressive, speculative, highly levered buying on the Shanghai Commodity Exchange. We can see that now. I've been saying I thought Chinese retail was getting less credit for driving the market than they had because it made so much sense for people in China to buy gold.
Okay, let me jump to another. We had Claudia Norquist on with us, boy, about 2 months ago. We talked about copper. You know, I'm a long-term bull on copper, but man, have we ever had the last couple of months going on here since, what, mid-February?
Yeah, copper's up about 30% from the middle of February to where we are now. We're at two-year highs in copper now. I mean, it's a hell of a story, right? We're electrification and you can't produce enough of it and it takes forever to get a mine open and all that sort of thing. But I'll tell you from where I look at it right now, this is a very crowded trade. The open interest in the COMEX copper market is near all-time highs, as high as it was 5 years ago, say, when everybody was kind of getting the bit in their teeth about the opportunities to copper. Yeah, it's a great story, but, you know,
You got to pay attention to positioning and timing. So if you jump in right here, you might get bumped a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you're 30% from the low, so you got to appreciate that traders will take profits at this point or at some point here. I'm going to throw another commodity at you because, again, this is something that you've been mentioning on your blog, victordare.ca. But, man, you look at those natural gas prices at about a 25-year low. That could have a really nice positive impact if you start using more of it in North America.
Well, we have a lot of natural gas. In fact, we've got so much of it in places who are just burning it as it comes out of the ground because they can't put it in a pipe to take it anywhere. But from a bigger picture perspective, yeah, we're at a 25-year low in nat gas prices, you know, more or less. But if you inflation adjust that, you know, and what isn't, you know, like it's never been so cheap. So, and this is North America that's different than other places in the world. And I've been thinking that, you know, I mean, you can actually turn natural gas into gasoline, or you can make motors that'll burn natural gas. What an incredible competitive advantage natural gas being so cheap and so plentiful gives to North America vis-a-vis the rest of the world. I mean, if we can get to the point where we start using natural gas, which is less polluting, say, than gasoline, a transportation fuel. Anyway, I'm kind of keen on natural gas, but it's tough to buy because there's just so much supply out there.
Well, I'm going to also, I can't help myself, but the federal government has shown no interest in taking advantage of our natural gas, no matter what direction we're going, but I won't go into that today. I'll skip it. But here's the other thing. This is my travel log section. And it's something, of course, we both look at currencies all the time, you know, with Canadian dollar hovering around that 73 cent US dollar. But man, I'm still planning my trip to Japan and it's getting better every week.
Yeah, the Bank of Japan, they're just, I don't know, there must be some comedy show that we could think of, Amos and Andy or something. But the Bank of Japan, once again, left interest rates at zero. They're confident that within the next couple of years, they'll get inflation back down to where they want it. And we have this term, and I've seen it for, I don't know, 20 years, where people that are like trying to pick the bottom in the Japanese market, whether it's the bonds or currencies or whatever, we call it the widow maker trade, because the yen just keeps going down and down and down, and it's down again this week. It's at a fresh 34-year low. When you say travelogue, I mean, I've talked to Canadians here in Parksville who've gone over to Japan and just shocked at how cheap everything is. And they say, and the food's great.
So. Yeah. Well, you think about that. I mean, if I've never been, I want to go. I'm being serious when I say that. I love to have my currency cooperate with me. Even the Canadian dollar looks good compared to the yen, let alone if you have any U.S. cash there. But come on, the prices would be... you know, if I go back and tried to do this, say, 10, 11, 12 years ago, you know, the yen was about 50% greater. I mean, or double it, actually. It's about double what it was, you know. So this is not a bad time to be looking. And it's, an example of how we look at international stuff that come back down to impact us here.
Well, the Japanese yen traded to an all-time high against the U.S. dollar around 2011, 2012. Abe, who was the prime minister at that time, started his Three Arrows program to try to revitalize the Japanese economy and so on. So since then, the yen has fallen about 50%. But I also looked at some key charts of, say, the Indian currency, the Chinese currency, and they've also had a dramatic fall during that period of time. Think of it this way. The whole Asian space out there has got a kind of a mercantilist view on their currencies. You know, if the Japanese currency is down by 50%, they need to be competitive in terms of being an export from their economies. So the whole Asian space, let's say, leave Singapore out of that because it's different. The currencies are weaker.
Yeah, it's a reminder, though, that this is how you get impoverished. Devaluing a currency is no way to prosperity. I understand what you're saying. It makes the exports cheaper. You know, it looks like there's a competition going on, but I want to remind Canadians that a weak economy or a weak currency actually impoverishes people because you do import stuff that just went up. Your cost of living on any import, especially like Japan, which is importing their energy. So we think oil prices have gone up. The Japanese going, you're not kidding. Or even their natural gas prices. So it's a fascinating world that I think people have to become more sensitive to, is, again, the whole global scope of opportunity sometimes. But I'll give you another example very quickly. Warren Buffett famously went into the Japanese market, you know, as an investor. Well, when he converts back to U.S. dollar, the gains ain't quite so attractive. You know, we got to look at all of these things as they come back in there. But as I say, I'm a travelogue person. India's getting cheap. Japan's getting cheap. The rest of Southeast Asia is probably going to go with it. So there you go. I got my travel plans getting set.
Mike, I have to make a point here. Folks that are listening to us, you know, please do not rush out and go short the Japanese yen, because it's falling so hard. Right across the currency space here, people being long the U.S. dollar against other currencies, particularly the Japanese yen, the Swiss franc, and the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar. It's a very, very crowded trade right here, right now. And the fact that maybe we're even talking about it makes me...
Yes.
I'm inclined to be looking for opportunities here to see the trade turn and go the other way.
Especially as we say, and we just said that moments ago, we saw it with gold, we see it with other, you know, other things, is traders get in there. We're going to see it with copper coming up. We don't know at what price, but at this point, is that there's money to be made. There's people out there who have been short the Japanese yen. At some point, they will cover that short, lock in their profit. That covering will push the yen up. So we got to expect volatility after you've had sharp moves like that. But I'm still traveling. Okay. And that's why you've got your hands full. And that's why I really invite people to go to victoradair.ca, see these charts. They're amazing what's going on. I mean, wherever we point our finger, there seems like something abrupt has been happening, including in the stock market, including the reaction to the inflation number. But the U.S. has ignored the inflation number at the end of the week. All of that stuff is coming. It makes it a fascinating environment and one reason to keep up to date. Get Victor Adair on your side and check in with him at victoradair.ca. So thanks, Vic, for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. First, I want to take a walk down memory lane and some of the top hits of how our tax dollars are spent, wasted, or worse. Now, of course, some people don't care about that, including in the government, which is why you'd be hard-pressed to find any example of government implementing serious reforms to how the public sector operates, how they spend our money. I'm definitely not in that camp, by the way. I care how my money is spent, how I earn the money. I have to send it in. Well, I care what they do with it. That's why I've read every Auditor General's report, gosh, it's for nearly 40 years now. And I'm constantly appalled. Now, I appreciate that some of the numbers are simply too big to comprehend, like the billions wasted in the Phoenix Pay System, which Auditor General Michael Ferguson called mismanagement that is incomprehensible. And we don't care to look into COVID spending, of course. We already know that things like CERB were supposed to cost something like $24 billion, ended up costing $82 billion. Why? Because 8.9 billion CERB checks were sent out. The only thing was, that's six times more than the actual number of pandemic-related unemployed. But I think what really irks people, including me, is when politicians or government employees spend our money very differently than they would their own money. That's why so many Canadians were upset when Prime Minister Trudeau stayed in a $6,000 a night suite in London for the Queen's funeral. Really? $3,000 a night wouldn't do? Or the Governor General spending $801,418 of our tax dollars taking 32 guests to a four-day Frankfurt book fair. They stayed in five-star hotels like Frankfurter's Hof Hotel, Ritz-Carlton in Berlin. And that's not the first time, by the way. The Governor General's trip to Dubai had 45 other hangers-on along for the ride, and it cost taxpayers $1,307,000. They spent over $80,000 in food costs alone. It worked out to $218 a meal. Well, I don't know about you, but I personally have never had a $218. And that didn't include any beverages, by the way. It's $218 per meal. Well, I haven't had a $218 breakfast or lunch or dinner. And there's also, $337,000 spent on what was called the party flight for the defense minister, deputy minister, other VIPs. They were on a mission to boost morale of our overseas military. Well, $337,000. The reports of drunkenness were widespread, including two individuals who were so drunk, they're reported to have urinated on themselves. Or how about the $139,000+ spent by Canadian diplomats on circus tickets, you know, concerts and gala? And of course, we all know now about the $59 million blown on a Rive can. Maybe you don't recall the $182 billion in Investing in Canada plan, which Auditor General Karen Hogan, and she was echoing so many previous reports, stated the absence of clear and complete reporting on the Investing in Canada plan makes it difficult for parliamentarians and Canadians to know whether progress is being made against the intended objectives. As I say, that's sequel number 412. But the mismanagement of tax dollars is not a new story, obviously, but it does relate to the hottest topic of the day, the increase in capital gains taxes. We're supporters of the tax, and it's goofy, don't seem to understand that it's not only that some people feel that they're overtaxed or taxed to death, don't want to send any more money for no matter what, but also it's people like the chief editor-in-chief of Policy Options, Les Perot. He stated, the capital gains tax exemption brouhaha reminds me there's a small class of people who just think they should have an exemption from any taxes. I say, no, you've missed the point. I think there's a heck of a lot of people who are tired of sending in money, and it is hard earned, and having it blown. And that's whether they agree or not. Some people are tired of seeing that. Mismanagement, waste, or spending in a way our politicians would never spend their own money. And that, not understanding that, well, you deserve this week's Goofy. That's all the time we have this week. A reminder, we've got Andrew Rulin's webinar coming up. That's on Tuesday. It's at 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain. You can just sign on, and it's free, of course, by going to mikesmoneytalks.ca. We'll put it right there, so I hope to see you then. But also, I want you to join us on Money Talks Tweets. I want you to join us on Michael Campbell's Facebook. I'll tell you, I still can't get over, I say it every week because it's true every week. There is a mountain of things that you're not seeing in the mainstream media that I think are relevant to your financial situation, to society in general, the declining confidence in society, major trends that are impacting our lives. So again, I hope you join us there. And also you can sign up on mikesmoneytalks.ca for 5 minutes with Mike. Love the feedback I'm getting, and I hope you have a terrific week.